Good afternoon. Welcome to the course I most enjoy teaching. One of the many things that you could reflect on during this course is whether it's a good or a bad thing for lecturers to be enthusiastic. Students often comment favourably on that, but of course a non-educational professional would almost always say about talks that the speakers ought to have their mind filled with the audience and not their own selfish concerns. But to be enthusiastic about a subject is exactly to largely withdraw attention from the audience and just think about what it is I'm trying to blurt out. So if you scour around enough in the literature, I found a wonderful quote, something like this, from a man called Peter Elbow, whose career was in teaching creative writing and writing in general. And of course, the general wisdom there is to be thinking about the audience for the writing. But the quote is, "Why do people only start paying attention when I start turn away from them and start, you know, gesticulating?" So there's one of the many paradoxes in this area. Now, where shall I begin? Let me begin with an irrelevant question. How many of you already have, even if you don't much use it, a Twitter account? Hands above the head, please, rather than down in the lap. Over half, but not everyone. Okay. Thank you. And one, well, I'll come back to that later. Right, so what's this course about? It's about learning and teaching, or education if you like, in higher education as opposed to the schools. Well, I'll discuss the caveats there in a moment. I'd like to begin, and I'll discuss the reasons for this later, for you to write down what your personal best and worst educational experiences ever have been. I mean, they can be recent, current, or further back if you're more struck by things. So first of all, take a moment and a piece of paper or, of course, a laptop. You aren't going to have to. Thank you for that. Why did I begin with that exercise? Well, actually, it's probably good practice anyway, but because this is an education module, here are the some justifications for it. One is because I think deep and thorough learning succeeds in getting the learner to not only be able to talk in the abstract and write in the abstract about what they're learning, but to relate that to their personal experience as well. And universities are notorious for being very, very skimpy on relating things to personal practice, even though that's half the job, because if you get turned out, you can't apply the knowledge without connecting it to your own skills and so on. So that's one reason to get you thinking about that, because a complete theory or set of theories for education ought to be able to explain for every both good and bad case that you brought up, it ought to be able to explain why it was good and why it was bad. So if you like, that also supplies a set of cases that we can test the area against. Another reason for this exercise is that or maybe a rewording of it, is it's constructivist teaching, generally thought to be an expression of how teachers should be. That is about getting the learners to construct their own views, and part of that is to be able to base that on their experience. The basic constructivist argument is that because, at least in the current limited state of technology, we can't just saw someone's top of someone's skull off and inject the knowledge, they actually always has to be constructed internally. That is, we can supply inputs to people, but we can't do the learning for them. So there's some profound, elementary, inescapable sense in which all learning is done by the learner, not by other people. And therefore the job of the teacher isn't, as everyone unconsciously believes it to be, about telling people stuff. It's about inducing them to do the construction themselves. So that's a handful of reasons for beginning with that. So, what's wanted on this course? Well, here are three exam questions from some year or other, which give a little bit of a flavour for the range of things. The last one actually challenged me, perhaps, required that the exam candidate should discuss the relative importance and give reasons for the relative importance of these three different elements, all of which you'll get some of in the course. One is theories, one is about really large effect sizes in a few studies, because although enormous amounts of the education literature of appallingly low quality from a psychological point of view, it's also true there are a few dramatic results hiding in there. And I'll introduce you to a few of them. And this is really, as it were, these learning designs are things a teacher can get learners to do, and concrete recipes are what would make the most impact on teaching practices, and I'll be introducing you to a few of those. So there are at least those three very different kinds of things, and I'm putting them together in this course because I feel that's what someone who is interested in whether or not there's anything worth knowing in the field of teaching and learning has sort of got to juggle those three things. Ask, of course, about the relationships between them, but also not focus on one and forget the existence of the others. This is saying almost the same thing, but relating it to the words in the title of the course. You'll be getting theories, or if you prefer, concepts. Actually, you'll be getting a mixture of theories that are well published in the literature, and also some more or less unpublished notions of mine. I hope you'll be able to tell the difference and apply correct amounts of skepticism. Number two is the big empirical results. Three is specific learning designs, which you could think of as the applied science part of it, or you could think of as the treatments that an experimentalist would consider giving participants in an educational experiment. All right. Now, my slides have almost no references on them. This slide is to tell me to point out vividly. I should have prepared this while you were talking. How silly of me. Wakey, wakey. Here we go. Although there is a Moodle for this course, it doesn't have the content on it, just has a pointer back to this page. This is a web page from which this course will be run. There's various stuff on it. I'll put the slides up here and so on. But most of the important is I've got a large unstructured reading list. If I mention something, search the reading list in the first case. Most of the entries here are annotated to say what it's about. For instance, Brahmi et al. Are about Dr. Fox type experiments. I'll be mentioning later today. What's the next one? This and thatty one is about judgment of teachers by students. So there are lots there, but to some extent you can You can search it for keywords, for instance, peer effects there. So for instance, Jigsaw method is a particular learning design I'm very impressed with, and I hope to be talking about in later sessions. At first, when one of you brought up the teacher using the idea of football teams, I thought this was about the learning design. It wasn't, it was a metaphor for equations, but actually one in some ways powerful way of teaching is to divide the class into teams. Each team has to learn up from outside sources, not from the teacher, their share of the day's or the week's assignment, and then they are the main source for the rest of the class to cross-teach. And that has enormous social effects, generally positive. It has also probably the single most powerful learning technique, one you might wish to adopt during revision for exams, is trying to teach someone else something for the first time has enormous effects on the person trying to teach. It may or may not help the recipient, but the experimental evidence is quite clear in almost every case that the student attempting to teach another student learns that topic much more deeply. And so Jigsaw also has that going for it. Anyway, I just wanted to give you actual sites. You'll be wanting to check that list frequently. Doesn't mean it's exhaustive, but it's and there's far too much on it for you to read everything, at least between now and May, but you do want to be consulting it. Okay, so part one of today's session. I'm going to make some remarks about the nature of learning in higher education. Sorry, I wrote a contents list there. For me, let's hope I cover it all. So, first of all, what's this like? So first of all, most of the studies of learning in the psychology literature are not applicable to educational learning, and certainly not at university. That's a slight overstatement, but by and large it's true. Why is that? Well, there are many reasons. One is it's convenient to get people to memorize stuff in learning experiments over the course of a few minutes and be tested within the hour. But as you know, universities and even schools aren't organized like that. You learn over many months and you're tested on an exam at the end of the year. The scale is utterly different, not just the time scale, but the kind of learning and so on. But probably more important than that is that in higher education, this is deliberate learning. So the first point to make around that is that probably most of what I say applies in schools as well, but it doesn't apply all the way down. I'm not sure where the boundary is, but my guess is it's probably the most important boundary is somewhere between age 4 and age 7. Why is that? Because in university, it's very clear that it's up to the student to learn. On the whole, people aren't going to harass them into doing things. If they lose interest in learning, stop taking self-driven actions, they'll learn very little. Actually, they might learn a lot of interesting stuff, but it won't be the stuff on the curriculum. But when children are born, and for the first several years of their life, it's different. They don't know they're learning, they just do it. And you've probably heard enough in other lectures about language learning to have some sense of the huge rate and pace at which a child learns their first language. But they're not learning it because they have a curriculum and because they're being tested. They learn it without having any intention of learning, but they're very effective. Now, somewhere, that kind of changes, and that's politically controversial. So I gather, though this might be out of date, that in Scandinavia there's nothing like official tests until age 7 or something like that. And here the government's continually lowering the age at which children are tested. And along with that test comes the idea that parents and teachers are anxious about them, and they probably start effectively bullying the child. So there's a question where that transition is, but in higher education it's completely clear. This is about deliberate action. If the person doesn't understand they should be learning or doesn't agree with other people's goals for them, then they won't do much learning. To put it another way, to try and get this little point under your skin, I was blown away when I read the preface to Seymour Papert's Mindstorms. Now, Seymour Papert is a very special person. He was one of Jean Piaget's own PhD students. He was clearly brilliant in his own right. He went back to America and his big thing in his quite prominent career was about the importance of having every school child learn to program computers. Never mind that, but the point he makes in this, the preface of this book stuck with me. He said, we're all familiar with how almost no child has any trouble learning their first language, but almost all of us have considerable trouble learning a second language in school. It feels quite different. He then points out, which I've been too dumb to think of before, is that you can say the same thing about mathematics. That is, if you in any way accept Piaget's analysis of a lot of development, Piaget points out that children acquire various conservations. These are highly abstract and essentially mathematical ideas, at least they are when an academic talks about them, but the child picks them up without any of that lecturing. And they pick them up again without pressure or organisation from teachers. And yet somehow, and you sit them in the classroom and tell them they're going to learn mathematics, about 90% come away with the conclusion they'll never learn mathematics, and the rest do, but with considerable effort. Now, I think that's a very interesting remark about Papert, but whether it's right in every way, it illustrates the difference between doing something and learning with ferocious success, but without the intention or the external organisation, versus having it organised for you where the will to learn or the social obligation to learn is the one driving thing. It's very different. Now, from a point of view of a psychology student, another way of putting this is that when something is deliberate, that is, when it's an intentional goal, then you have to start thinking about learning not as a primitive function in the brain, but as having a number of important features. So first of all, it has to be deliberate and willed. Therefore, the strength or weakness of the motivation is going to be one of the biggest factors that decide whether it happens. However, when you intend to do a goal, you also plan how to do it. You don't have a goal and then your muscles start jerking. It's mediated by a plan. And that means no matter how big your motivation, another important causal factor will be whether you have effective plans or whether you have mistaken ideas about the method of learning. So for undergraduates, we've actually typically picked up quite a lot of important learning skills, but equally typically it's rare for undergraduates to realise it's worth spending hours of their time trying to teach someone else because that is a very effective method of learning. Few of them have that plan in their repertoire. So that's an example of how changing a learner's, the toolkit a learner thinks of using for their learning can also make a big difference, even for constant motivation. And another important thing is that it's an activity. That is, this isn't a primitive action, it's not a one-off event, it's a sustained pattern of activity. It has to be and is managed by the individual. Consists of a complex assembly of actions, but the point is that it's regulated by that person's judgment about whether or not they've done enough. In fact, you know, a lot of what we do in life is like that. Much, not all that much, it seems to be published about the ways in which we come to be able to judge whether we've done enough. And in education, that's an issue too. How does a student know they've done enough? And if you think about it, well, maybe you're vividly aware already, but for those who aren't, if you think about you revising for an exam, how do you know when you've done enough? I mean, apart from issues of whether you've got enough time and whether you've got clever or clumsy methods, how do you decide you've done enough on one subject? Well, this leads in slightly to things I'll come back to in a slide. But first of all, because it's an intentional action, then motivation matters. There are some theories of motivation in the psychology literature, and at least some of them, such as Pintrich's, have been applied to some extent. For instance, Pintrich's makes several distinctions. One of them is between, I think he calls them approach goals and avoidance goals. So some goals you have are things you want more of, like making money or acquiring a family. Avoidance goals are sometimes called hygiene goals, are about things to avoid. And in the experiments he does, there's some differences in people's behavior depending on which of those types of goals are. So there are some theories, but actually I think they're all seriously inadequate because of the following phenomenon. So my colleagues are fond of saying that students in this department aren't what they used to be, they will look younger than they did, blah 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 blah, but above all they won't do anything if they don't get credit for it. They're just instrumental, goal-driven little bastards, yes. That's the grumble. However, it's actually entirely possible to make virtually every student do what I want if it's in a different situation. So with my level 3 tutorial group, I sit them down, and it's a group of 5 or 6, sit them down around the table. First thing I do in the first meeting is saying I'm going to get them to do this exercise over the next 2 weeks about critiquing each other's work. And this is a significant amount of work. It means they have to read 2 long essays each and produce some both positive and negative criticisms, and then feed them back. And nobody ever resists this. They all do it. So obviously some completely different motivation system is going on. And I think this is probably an illustration of, well, one of the things it is, it's an illustration of the difference between solitary action and group action. So if a student's sitting down at home and they know the lecturer's recommended this, they're still not going to do it unless they understand the reasons for that. And those reasons are enough to make them feel it's worth committing the time. But we have a completely different set of criteria for what we'll go along with when we're in a group. We don't have no criteria. I probably couldn't get them to, I don't know, do a striptease. Probably if I had extra charisma, I might be able to get them, but it would be harder to each stand up and sing for a minute. That would be pushing it, but I might just be able to do it. So I'm not saying we don't have any criteria. I'm just pointing out that what we'll do is utterly different in a social situation with a person who temporarily is a leader for the moment. So what I'm saying is, although psychology says it has theories of motivation, it's probably completely missing half of them, and a half which are quite important in education. So, I mean, maybe I should have made my example a bit clearer. So I began this, before you even knew me in any sense, with getting you to discuss with each other your best and worst experiences, and none of you looked reluctant. You all did it. You could, if you were a truly solitary oriented person, might have said, I came here to listen, what's he doing making us discuss, but none of you looked as if you were going to reason in that way. Whereas if I'd sent you an email before the class saying, find someone else in the class in advance and have 15 minutes chat about your best and worst experiences and bring them to the class. How many of you do you think would have done that? Probably a few, but any of you have actually got organised, taken the initiative? Exactly. So that's another sort of way in which it's motivation works differently in different contexts. I'll discuss some of these. There's different things. There's a variety of concepts that relate to motivation in one way or another. Now, other senses of the nature of learning. Here are some more points. First of all, it's important to realise that we use the word learning and not many of us stop to reason about its meaning much at all. But one fundamental distinction from the psychology memory literature actually has some relevance, and that's recall versus recognition. So certainly the Western world's idea of academic tests is all about solitary performance, as in an exam room. And that is about, although it involves skills and many other things, it is basically about what you can recall on the spot from a very slim stimulus in the exam question. And yet, it's frequently argued, not without some validity, that much of the adult world is not like that. It's a social world, and and that involves often recognition knowledge, that is, being able to look at a situation and recognise what pattern that falls into. And that's a quite different kind of memory, as the cognitive literature shows. And apparently there are cultures where that is the only kind of learning that is valued. So for instance, on the reading list there's an old book chapter on cross-cultural studies that makes this point about what kind of learning is valued. There are at least a few who value recognition over recall, but we have to recognise about our educational system that in the end, its definition of learning is pretty much what you can recall rather than what you can recognise. There's a topic you can find if you search for it called situated learning, which is in some way related to this. Situated learning, I think, is about the idea that even for topics which you might have thought were connected to school learning, there's a strong contextual aspect to that, partly about people not learning a general form of the knowledge, but it's also about what triggers it. So there were anthropological studies, probably several decades ago now, on Brazilian street traders, and many of which are children, and showing that they would be far superior to me, certainly probably to most of you, at things like adding up bills in their head and making change. So a tremendous grasp of money-related arithmetic, in practice, able to deliver it, and doing what to a mathematician is the same calculations in the school, using digits and paper, they're, you know, useless at it. So that would be an example of how, from an abstract point of view, they've got it, and yet school, it doesn't connect to school knowledge, it doesn't come out. Second issue here is, how do you know when you've learned? What's the measure of it? Well, if you look in the right places in the literature, you can find discussions. Perhaps the most obvious concept, just to stick in the back of your mind, is about transfer. So transfer is about whether you can connect a bit of knowledge in your head to a new situation, and how novel does a situation are you able to bridge over. So from this perspective, all learning involves a bit of transfer. After all, if you tell me your name on a Tuesday, will I remember it on Wednesday? If you tell it to me in a bar, will I remember it in the classroom? even the most trivial kinds of information learning involve a bit of transfer. But the interesting thing is basically the further the transfer, the more impressive, the more thorough a bit of learning it is. So it's one thing to learn a bit of algebra, it's another to be able to see how it would apply to, I don't know, a problem of calculating how much paint you have to buy to paint a room in your house or something. So one idea about a measure of learning is the degree of not just whether you can remember it in a literal rote learning reproductive sense, but whether you're able to transfer that knowledge to apparently different situations. Another issue that might interest you, but I probably won't be talking about much, is when do you know you've learned? So in the memory literature, there's something called metamemory. I've put in hyphens for this slide, but they're usually spelt without hyphens. Metamemory is about something we've all pretty much experienced, which is you sometimes, when someone asks a question and you can't think of the answer, you often have a strong sense that you know it, you just can't get it at the moment, but you know you got it, versus other cases where you're asked a question and you know you don't know it. You know that immediately. So psychologists have been quite interested in that, not only because it's a real human phenomenon, but because it's obviously useful. Because if you know you know it, even if you can't retrieve it, you can try and work on the retrieval, you have different expectations for what you'll do next, than if you're convinced you don't know it and there's no point in you struggling, you need to find it out again. So that's about memory, and that's typically about little bits of information, like someone's name, whether you have seen them before or not. You could ask the same question about knowledge. Do I know this or don't I? And a phrase you see a lot of is metacognition, but that means a number of different things. So if you ever look at the metacognition literature, the critical question you want to have before you even open the first paper is, what did this author mean by metacognition? And if they don't define it, that's a bad mark against them, because that shows they're actually being showing ignorance of the fact that a lot of literature will define it differently from them. Staying with what I'm calling meta-knowledge for the moment, like, you know, do you know algebra? Do you know what to do when a student bursts into tears in your office? One of the reasons I think that's interesting is because it's not clear how we do it, and I think in many cases we're not necessarily very good at it. So here's an example that relates to students. As many of you will know, in level 3 you get to do 2 critical reviews. And it was common for me, till I found a way to maneuver around this, it's common for me to write a lot of feedback on the first critical review, ensure the students actually read that. They would often express gratitude, feel I'd showed proper attention and care, but then if they were relaxed enough, they'd nevertheless look me in the eye, and this would be the best student, not just the worst, and say, that's all very well, but the next critical review will be entirely different and for a different tutor, and I don't expect this to be any use to me. And I found that terribly, terribly depressing. But I now think one reason for that is that that isn't actually evidence that they wouldn't find it useful in the future. It's that they couldn't foresee the way in which it would be useful. And one of the reasons I think that is because I think it's not till we're faced with a new case or a new situation and we find something coming into our head that we realize we have something in our head that will pop up and suggest a solution. And I think that's not just true, that could be true of the first time we do any task. We realize we've succeeded at that task with some help, but we've no idea whether that will generalize in future. It's only after you've faced with new situations that you may find it works. And I think that's not just true in cases like that in education. I think it may be even more true in professional practice. So if I'm feeling uncertain how to respond to some demand or some teaching situation, I go and chat to a colleague, they'll often come out with a solution, and they don't have the air of, I've always known this, this is on page 53 of the teacher's instruction handbook, why didn't I remember that? They don't have that air at all. It's as if they'll say something like, well, why don't you do this? And they have the air of, they've never said that to anyone else, but it's coming out of their experience by a kind of pattern matching about the cases. And I think a lot of professional knowledge, and all kinds of professions are like that, that the more experience you have, you know you've got more experience, but you don't probably have any acute sense of the extent to which that's useful until you find yourself able to give advice in this case, or being able to do better than you would have done 5 or 10 years before, and the solution just occurs to you more or less immediately. So I think quite a lot of our knowledge is stashed away, probably as part of episodic memory, but that when faced with a new situation, our wonderful associates of memories are able to fish out things that are potentially useful. And but the thing about knowledge being partly encoded like that is that it probably doesn't come with meta-knowledge. You don't know very much about what you know until you've used it. And even when you've used it once, you may not understand that it would be useful, or when it will be useful in future. So that's what I'm getting there, that although we clearly do have some sense of how much we know, it's rather mysterious and it's not always accurate. Now this point is one that will come up later in the course as well. How can I express it? To express it as if I was a philosopher. Our culture's dominant common sense epistemology is that knowledge is in the head, that what learning is to get the knowledge in the head, after which I can use it autonomously and independently. We feel that about a lot of things. Putnam was a philosopher, and long ago I read an essay of his which seems to have sunk right in and is relevant here. He produced a short paper in which he argued that even for things which we have direct personal experience of, and therefore you might think that our knowledge of them is rooted in our personal experience, actually there's also in the end an important social component of the following kind. So he used two examples predominantly in this essay. One was water and one was gold. Probably pretty much everyone touches and uses water every day of their life, and for many people that would be true of gold if they wear gold jewellery or have a partner who does. So these are very familiar in an everyday sense, and we also know quite a bit that we've picked up from school and things. So it's not merely experiential sensory motor knowledge, it's also conceptual knowledge. So you all know, for instance, that that water can, ice and water vapor are all the same thing, that if you drop an ice cube out of the fridge onto the floor and are too lazy to pick it up, an hour later it will have been turned into a pool of water, and if you remain lazy and your flat is centrally heated, 12 hours later it will have vanished into water vapor. So that's theoretical knowledge of a kind, and it's reliable, and you know, how could you know anything better than things like water and gold? And yet, Putnam's argument is that if you're challenged, so to take gold first, most of us could say quite a lot of things, most of us know it's a yellow metal and we've seen it frequently. If you did a little chemistry, you might even know that it's almost the densest element there is. That is that 1 cc of gold is 23 times heavier than an cc of water, it's more than twice as dense as lead. Some of you might know facts like that, but if I give you a sample of light yellow metal, you probably wouldn't be that confident that it was whether it was pure gold, whether it was an alloy of gold, or whether it was platinum. So that, now, a jeweler would know a bit more. You push and push. What do you really think about it? Well, in the end, you're quite happy with the idea that although you know a lot about gold, in the end, what you want to mean by the word gold is whatever, let's say, the government, official government chemist says. We aren't trying to be idiosyncratic about it. We know a lot, but we don't know everything. We, in the end, will ground that knowledge not on a person, not on experiments we've done personally, but on some other authority. And the same for water. There's a notion of heavy water, which is H2O, where the hydrogen atoms are a different isotope of hydrogen, so it's very slightly different in density. But none of us would be able to recognize it. If you gave me a glass of heavy water, I'd never know the difference. I'd drink it. I wouldn't easily be, I'd have to think long and hard about how I'd attempt to find out the difference. And what do I mean by water? Whatever the national expert would say. Now, I say all that just because, as I said a moment ago, it's our common sense ideas about what it is to know something are not all, in fact, aligned with our real practice. And part of our real practice is the way that even the kind of knowledge that we have direct contact with every day through our senses is still is partly based on what other people think. So that's something that feels very unnatural to me with my cultural background and my particular training, which is originally in cognitive science, which is, and cognition is mostly based on what individuals do by themselves and is skimpy on the social dimension. But social dimensions matter in education in several ways, and one of them is about the grounding of knowledge. I'm going to introduce briefly a few larger facts, and they're also related to the other issue which lies behind the rest of this session, which is, in are teachers important, or is it just learners? And if teachers are important, in what way are they important? So there are a number of challenges to comfortable salary men like me who assume that this is a job for life, and of course that teachers are necessary. There are a number of challenges. So the first one is about learning without teachers. So Alan Tuff, Canadian researcher, and his big, he worked in adult education, and that led him to think, to focus on how much learning went on outside institutions. You can find his book free on the web. I'm pretty sure it was there when I last looked. And basically, he developed an interview which he and his many enthusiastic followers have now applied in many different countries and to many different age groups. And roughly speaking, I don't know if it's true of undergraduates, because if your full-time job learning, you might not want to be learning much else outside. But for everyone else, anyway, from the age of 16 to the age of 60, a large majority have done at least, set themselves to learn one, at least one thing, often more than one. Average was 5 projects a year. The amount of time they spent was averaged about 10 a week. And 80% of this was done without teachers. I mean, typically a person who sets themselves a goal like that will then look round to see whether there's a course that will help them locally. But often there isn't, either because it isn't on that topic or it doesn't suit their other time constraints. So the majority of this ended up being self-taught. But a feature of this, and why he used interviews, and why questionnaires wouldn't do at all, is that everyone denies this at first. You have to sit with them, you have to talk them through the definition of a learning project, get people to reclassify what they're doing in their head. But actually, there's a lot of it going on. So this is kind of the prompt they get at the start of the interview. So it's very hard to resist this evidence. It looks as if adults, at least, can learn rather well by themselves. Furthermore, they do it. They organise their own motivation, their own method. And among many, so first of all, it casts serious doubt on whether teachers are important as the teachers think they are. But also, it's probably a critical thought you should always have in mind in reading the educational literature, because a lot of it is about comparing teaching methods and simply presupposes without evidence that the framework needs to be school or something like it, when the real alternative may be learning without teachers. I'm just going to mention these, but you can follow them up through the reading list. Much more recently than Alan Tuff, there's this very interesting man. Have any of you heard of him? No. He's Indian by origin. First half of his career, he worked in a research institute. He was a physicist of some kind. And then he did the hole-in-the-wall experiment, which I'll describe in a moment, and has made quite a splash in the education world, and now has an education academic job at the University of Newcastle in England. Okay, so he worked in this institute in Mumbai if you prefer, and it was quite close to the wall, to the slum, and he drilled a hole in this wall. He put a PC and a keyboard in the hole, and nothing else. So the internet connection it had. And what he observed was that the slum kids would, none of whom, of course, English wasn't the first language of any of them, and the language of the internet even more a few years ago than now is English, but they would typically organize themselves into groups of four. Four is about as many as can look at a standard computer screen together, and they would set about learning stuff. They'd set their own agenda, and they'd learn an amazing amount. And the point is, there was no teacher in sight, not before, not during. So this is even more than Alan Tuff. This is a a threat to job security for teachers. If you read the details, it's not entirely true that teachers were not in some ways connected, because quite often the stuff they'd look up was stuff they hadn't understood in schools. Or actually one thing, I might be muddling more than one of his study together. Why Saugata Mitra was interested in this is because India certainly has an education system, but it's also, as you know, a rapidly developing country. So this means that there's more or less true that there's a school in every village, but that there's not enough teachers, as many teachers as you'd like. If you're a teacher, like all middle class people, you would much rather be in the city than in the country, so the villages who need the best teachers get the worst teachers, because the best teachers can get the best jobs. So that's why this is important. One of the disadvantages of the teachers who are less fully qualified is they know English because it's a required subject, but their accent is rubbish. And what are the prospects for many Indians, particularly slum kids, if getting a job at a call centre and being able to speak British in English with a good accent is a really competitive thing? One of the things that slum kids could do with this terminal, if they could find audio recordings, people with American or British accents. So you could say that this was a supplement to schools, that in some sense the kids had some of their learning goals were derived indirectly from teachers, and that this was just a different learning opportunity. Mitra's done a number of studies, but one that really got me for a different reason was because it again suggests a use for teachers, but completely not the one that society is focused on. Because society is focused on qualified teachers, and subject knowledge is very important, and pedagogic knowledge is the next most important thing in the official view of teachers. Now, what was this, a grandmother effect? At least in Mitra's talk on this, he says that this is true, I think, in Britain, but it's like 10 times more true in India, that the role of the grandmother at the moment in India is to talk to young children as they come back from school and to give them unconditional positive regard, as Carl Rogers would say. So most parents actually don't understand much of what their kids learn in schools, but Indian grandmothers certainly don't understand the technical content of what is being taught. Their job is to provide personal attention and encouragement without any technical input at all. Mitra tried this out by hiring grandmothers in Gateshead in England and pairing them up over the internet with rural kids in India with great success. There's a grandmother script that's clearly international and language independent. It has measurably positive effects on learning. It's not to do with transmitting content. So that would be an example where teachers are important, but not for the reason that everyone assumes, including the government and people who pay teachers and people who exclude unqualified teachers and all of those, could be said to be beside the point. Now, I'll just mention this. It's not well integrated into this lecture yet. This is about the phenomenon of video games, because as far as I can see, essentially video games are exhibiting the enormous drive to learn that most, I assume all humans have, and that this is utterly independent of whether it's of any use. Because the point about video games is that they're all they're all about forcing the game player to learn the rules of the game, and then they don't make it easy. You don't get a rule book. You have to discover what the damn rules are. And why would you want to do that for these completely artificial virtual worlds? And yet the video game industry is enormous. It's got far greater global turnover than Hollywood films do, for instance. It's enormous, just enormous. And it's more or less independent of gender these days. It's got a wide range of ages. It seems to me that video games exhibit a very strong amount of intrinsic motivation to learn stuff that's utterly unconnected with extrinsic, that is, utilitarian reasons. So I think that's another thing to bear in mind, and we've got to ask. There's some details I don't think there's time to dwell on, but the real question is, why does organised education do so poorly at interesting students when an industry can charge them money to learn something that's guaranteed to be of no use? It's again why I feel that current psychological theories of motivation are not doing well in the context of learning. Could I just ask, how many of you play video games at all regularly? No one's going to admit it? This survey not done on this class, then. I see. Important feature, I think, of video games is that you learn by trying things out, or play is probably, in fact, an accurate word to use. It's not on the reading list yet, but I'll put it there. There's a book which I've only just had recommended to me, but which is probably important here, about how software designers in general certainly video game designers, but software designers in general, seem to have learned a lot from the industry which designs slot machines in gambling casinos in Las Vegas, which is all about creating an addiction. So, if you want a negative spin, that book will be the one, and I'll get it on the reading list during the next week. But certainly I think the mode of learning in video games is important, as well as my arguments about the amount of intrinsic motivation we seem to have for learning independent of utility. Okay, so my theme in this little section is about our teachers' importance, and if so, in what way. A completely different part of the literature, which I was alerted to by Dylan William. Notice there's only one L in this, the way he spells it, it's Dutch in origin. He's a professor at the Institute of Education in London, which is currently the biggest research centre for education in Britain. This is true in Britain, but the most publications are about the American school system. Now, there's a double whammy here. So the first one is that teachers really are important. How do we know that? Because if you look at all the kids in one school, you judge a teacher's worth by how well the kids do. That's how you know whether they're a good teacher or not. Then the difference in the average amount of learning a child has with the best teacher and the worst teacher in the school is huge, and it's much bigger than the difference between going to the best or worst school in the city. So the old-fashioned socialist argument is that it's all about money and class. Actually, that's apparently not true in school system. At least it's still true, but the effect is not nearly as big as the effect of whether you get the best or worst teacher. So that's one half of it. Teachers really matter. The other half is we have absolutely no idea, really, or no evidence about what makes a good teacher. So if you follow up the Chingos et al. Or the Hanushek papers, you'll see data from the American school system that seems to show convincingly that when judged by pupil results, there are no good predictors, there are no effective predictors of what it is about that teacher. So if they go to the most prestigious or the least prestigious educational institution for who trains the teacher, doesn't seem to make a difference. Whether they have a postgraduate degree or just an undergraduate degree, doesn't predict. And even how many years' experience they have is often not a significant predictor, particularly after the first year. So I think this is tremendously important. If it's not about their training, because that's what the evidence seems to say, is that good or bad training isn't what makes the difference between a good or bad teacher, then they must only be getting their skills from practicing. That means, for a start, you've got to have schools with bad teachers in, because before they got their experience they won't be effective. So that's something the government wouldn't like a conclusion to be drawn about, is that they only get good by practicing, and some of that will be damaging to the children. But more importantly, perhaps, is it implies that what makes a good teacher is not about conscious knowledge, it's not about theories, it must be a tacit skill. Because if it wasn't tacit, then we'd know how to train it, how to transmit it. And it seems clear that we have no idea how to transmit it. if you want to follow that up, there's certainly a few references you can read, but I think it's quite dramatic. It may be not quite as this is probably over optimistic thing to say, but when I tried this argument out on an old friend I was meeting again after years, who turned out she'd spent her time as a senior person in a teacher training college, her main rider to that was that that she certainly didn't think training could turn a useless teacher into a good teacher, but that probably quite a lot of the ones who had no aptitude for it in fact didn't enter the profession because they found out how ineffective they were in their probationary year and wandered off into some other profession. So it might not be quite as grim as it sounds because of a certain amount of self-evaluation. Now, do some exercise, hand them out. I want to introduce you to a notion about, there are two sides to that handout. You can start with the simpler side. The idea is that what teachers do falls into different categories, each of which should be separately considered. So, you might not be aware of this, but the classical way of looking at university academics is they have three kinds of things to do: research, teaching, and admin. Teaching, which is what we're interested in here, could be split into delivery, which is actually what everyone thinks about, how well a person gives a talk or chairs a tutorial, into designing or selecting learning activities. So this afternoon we had a bit of group discussion and a lot of monologue. And there's the question of who actually designs the curriculum. So there are three roles, and although I probably don't have time to discuss them, it's possible to elaborate on the curriculum design aspect. So the main three roles then: delivery, role three; knowledge selection and how you're going to express it, role one; and designing learning activities. So I'll talk about examples from each of those in the succeeding slides, but you have to realize that everyday conversations by academics themselves, as well as everyone else, focuses on lecturing. So in the course evaluations, are required to ask about whether the lectures were good. As you'll see in a moment, there's evidence that makes no difference to learning outcomes. It makes a difference to whether students think the lecture is worthwhile having, but it doesn't make a difference to their exam results, even though that's the one that everyone thinks of. Role one is probably really what we most think of. After all, if you want to learn something, I don't know, how to be an effective political lobbyist, normally our first criteria for selecting someone to teach us is that they know the stuff, not that they're skilled at giving it, but most of all we want to be reassured they really know the stuff. In university, that's what's important in making a selection of what to teach. That's subject expertise. And the middle one, the design of learning activities, is actually what the bulk of the education literature tends to be about, at least the kind of literature I read, because it's susceptible to direct comparisons and experiments. But there's a lot on that, and a lot of learning activities don't show a big effect, but a few at least have shown truly large effects. So, as I say, the literature focuses on that, common sense focuses on that, and that is our requirement for expertise, really. And the real point is that because those functions are unlike each other, there's no reason to think a person who's good at one is good as another. They're independent. They're independent of each other. So, if you search through my oversized reference list for the key phrase Dr. Fox, or just Fox, you'll pick out the various papers, mostly old ones on this. So the main idea here, this was experiments done in the 70s. The basic method was someone wrote the script of a lecture, hired an actor, got the same actor to deliver the same script, but with what they called high or low expressiveness. So doing their best to be engaging, or not making an effort to be engaging at all. They then played these videos to students and tested them for knowledge afterwards. But in not the first, but the more sophisticated experiments later on, they did a 2x2. So there was the high and low expressiveness video, and the other condition was whether the students were told in advance they would be tested on this and this would have a bearing on their overall mark for the course, or whether the students believed it wouldn't make any difference. And statistically, there was an interaction. So if students believed it mattered to them, they would learn indistinguishably well from both cases. If they didn't believe it mattered to them, it made a huge difference, the quality of the presentation. So I think the moral of that is if you get a job in advertising or in health promotion, you need to focus on your presentation skills very much, because the audience doesn't want to listen to you, will listen to you only to the extent that you appear to be engaging. If you have a safe job like mine, you can afford to lecture really badly and the students will give you bad ratings, but they'll do just as well in exams because they will compensate. In fact, and that again, you see, is entirely consistent with what I said about higher education and probably a lot of the school system is dominated by the fact that this is a deliberate planned activity. And by at least by university, students are sufficiently skilled and sufficiently motivated that they will make themselves get a good outcome regardless of the quality of the delivery. In fact, this point came home to me some years ago when I was chatting to a student, and she mentioned that she'd just completed level 3, I think, and she mentioned that in one of the level 3 courses, at the first lecture, she realized she wasn't going to understand a single thing from this lecturer, and that made her so anxious that she worked harder on that course than all the others. She ended up with a higher mark on that course than all the others and had to stop herself doing more of it in level 4 because she got the highest marks, but she still hated it. So in other words, the kind of students we get in this department, but I have no reason to think that isn't general, not only compensate, but you could even say they overcompensate for bad delivery. So that means if what I care about is whether students learn, I shouldn't waste any time improving lecturer delivery. If I want to improve student ratings, then I'd better pay some attention to that. But if I really have an applied educational motivation, then what matters is how much learning goes on, and lecture delivery isn't a significant factor according to this set of experiments. Now, just slipping in an argument inspired by Vygotsky. That there are, of course, different kinds of delivery, and monologues to a large group like this lecture is only one kind. But the kind of learning that Vygotsky focused on is about setting an example and scaffolding the learner into picking up more and more of what the lecturer does. And that's a very different kind of delivery, and it's probably not by any means absent in higher education. So history lecturers, I believe, particularly when they're giving a lecture, they tend not to expect students to believe what they're saying. They're expecting students to view it as a performance of a certain kind which a historian of a particular type is given, and that they should judge it critically with that understanding, not on the basis of sincerity or naive truth, which science lecturers promote. I think too that it depends hugely on the subject, but for instance, I have a friend who lectures in computer science. Sometimes he'll try and write bits of software code on the board, try and get the audience to participate. And those performances are not only a demonstration of how you might talk and reason, but they somehow work better if the lecturer makes a mistake, because of course everyone makes mistakes when they do this, and seeing a flaw, I mean, going to watch the best violinist in the world doesn't give you the faintest clue about how to play the violin well. It's more helpful to have a faulty performance that's more closer to what your experience will be. So probably part of the education, the optimal demonstration is to have some mistakes creep in which are then corrected, and the fact that they are made but corrected, the way in which they're corrected, are all in fact part of what the learner needs in the long run to pick up. Okay. Now, I said role one was about curriculum design, or to put it another way, deciding how to present knowledge. And this is the biggest result I've ever seen. Most students deny that it's educational, because after all it's about this low-level skill. But I think, although I haven't got such a well-documented example, because this example... anyway, I'll just tell you what it is. Okay, so as you know, in this country and a number of others, we eat loads of hen's eggs. People in the business of mass production of eggs for the last 100 years have been not only about the density of hens, but also, if you're into egg production, you need to hatch just a few of the eggs to provide the next lot of hens. You hardly need any males at all, you just want females. The trouble is, when you look at a newborn chick, you can't tell what sex they are, at least. No, you can't tell, I can't tell. So for a long time they had to grow them all for 6 weeks before they could see which were male and recycle most of the males. And then the Japanese learned how to do it, but this was tacit knowledge. They could train people to do it, but they didn't know how to do it. The Americans hired in Japanese trainers. The training used to take about 6 to 12 weeks to get a novice up to the speed and accuracy useful for chicken sexing. So that was the method. It took 6 to 12 weeks full-time learning. And then these Nosey Parker psychologists took this as a case. They interviewed the chick sexers, and they managed to produce an instruction leaflet that took only about a minute to read and produced the same effect as 6 to 12 weeks of full-time learning. Now, to transform a minute into 6 to 12 weeks is a factor of something like 26,000 times. That is the biggest effect I've ever heard of for shortening learning time. And it's an indication of something that's almost entirely hidden and undocumented, which is that sometimes there's a breakthrough in how you express and convey knowledge. And I think it's just a fault of the structure of our society that this is undocumented, because you see, science works by researchers, the first researcher to publish something gets the credit. And that means that but to publish, the editor's going to require you to have references in. So researchers have to read the literature even if they don't want to, because that's the structure of how it works, and all the credit is for the first person to get the idea and to boast about it. So that also leaves a kind of history, an audit trail of who gets the credit, which is not unrelated to who did the work, even though it certainly got faults in it. When it comes to teaching, the opposite is true. If I write a textbook that expresses something much better than others, I may or may not get more sales at first, but all the other teachers who teach this subject don't want to give me the credit, because then they'd have to pay copyright. Instead, they will redraw the diagrams, paraphrase the words, use the method, and above all, they will never ever give any credit, because that would damage them. So I believe there this occasional sporadic progress has been made in every topic, but there almost never is there any trace about who had the breakthrough and how to express it. It's just everyone reuses it. And this is a rare case, and that's because some outside researchers who were interested actually in a different aspect happened to make a breakthrough and demonstrate its effectiveness. I have a few cases that probably won't make any sense to you because my first degree is in physics, and I've become aware of one or two things in physics where the notation changed, and biographers have mentioned just how much a difference it made. So one of them, for instance, is calculus, the kind you might have learnt at school or in first year of university if you were doing a science-related subject, was jointly invented by Newton on the one hand and Leibniz on the other. Now, because they were independent, they had quite different notations. Leibniz's notation was much easier for other people learning it, but the Brits, of course, were loyal to Newton and went on using his rubbish notation. Because after all, if you've got a brain the size of a planet, you can do the calculations even when the notation's rubbish. But if you're a more ordinary student trying to learn it, it makes a big difference. And you can now see in histories of mathematics comments like mathematics in Britain was probably held back for 200 years by Newton's notation until people caved in and used Leibniz's. And that's just an indication of how a change in presentation, in technical presentation, can make huge differences to the learnability of a topic. But it's rare to have any kind of documentation on that, but it's probably slowly going on all the time. So that's one of the giant effects. Now, the second big effect is to do with design of learning activities, and I'm probably going to state the first one. This is a method developed some decades ago by Benjamin Bloom, a method of improving learning in ordinary middle school American classrooms. He achieved this shift in scores by applying this method. So whereas the regular tests showed a typical normal distribution in the class, with mastery learning, on a weekly cycle, you could effectively remediate the children until they were pushing up against the ceiling. And that effect size was one standard deviation, effect size of one. And that's large in most people's scales. And they showed it for both English and maths. They showed it in several schools. So that's a big effect, and that's about a learning method. Here's a different one, famous in a different way. I'll skip the comedy. the graph I'm going to show you is data gathered from many first-year university courses across the US adopting the new method. So the way to read this graph is the yellow ones said they had continued with the traditional method, the others all said they used the new method, which Haight called interactive engagement. You can see a few white ones down here, but really you don't need fancy stats to show this. The measure, this vertical axis, is normalized gain. What does that mean? These were all by particular circumstances meant there was a test made available nationally which wasn't used for awarding grades, but did test understanding of the topic of mechanics. And this was applied at the start of the course and at the end of the course, and all these instructors sent in their data for 1 year. Normalized gain means how much greater was the post-test. So it's post-test minus pre-test is the gain, and normalization means the gain divided by the total improvement of people who learned everything. And why is that important is because, depending on the institution and the student, they might arrive knowing a lot of this in advance or not. So normalized gain really is the percentage of gain the class on average made as a percentage of how much each individual could have done. Now, the pre-test axis is about how much they knew in advance. So over here, you've got institutions with intakes from schools have already taught them half the first year university curriculum and stuff. Over here, you've got lower prestige ones. You can see other ways prestige by the size of it. So what's impressive about this really is big effect, and it's effective over a very wide spread of quality in institutions and students. So this is big in the sense that this is very rare in the literature about a particular method of teaching applied in many different institutions and by and large effective in a wide range. Mazur, Harvard lecturer in physics, professor in physics, he taught a similar introductory course. It's very amusing when he gives talks about this because he said, I think like everyone, but it's more amusing coming from a snobby Harvard person, he said he couldn't believe the results from these tests about understanding. And it might be true in other universities. Sure, his students did better. He tried it out in his class and they did just as badly on the test as everyone else. So he then changed his teaching, and this is a paper after nearly 10 years of teaching. You see here the last year before he changed his method. This was the normalized gain. You can see even the first time he changed it, he had doubled the amount they learned, and it went on growing. Because he's a cautious physicist, he says he can claim he's doubled the effectiveness, but actually you can see he's tripled it by the end of it. I can't imagine a change in my teaching that would double the amount students learned. I mean, this is beyond measuring in effect sizes, really. I'll just give you a sense of what this particular method is, and it's spread quite a bit. It's used in computing science in this university. It really revolves. So instead of what would otherwise have been essentially a monologue to a gigantic class, hundreds of students, this one revolves around what I call brain teasers. That's not what Mazur would call them. And this is the example that first got me to understand what they were about. So the ideal question is easy to understand even by someone who knows no physics, but appeals, ideally, you can feel at least two of the answers tugging at you so that you kind of know you don't know. So that's an ideal kind of question that gets at you. How's it used? Have a slide showing the method. So the method's like this. First, the lecturer puts up a question, then gets students to vote on it. Nowadays that would be done with, 10 years ago that would be done with handheld clickers of some kind. These days it might be done on mobile phones. Everyone votes. Then With any luck, the class is split. One way of doing it, the lecturer would then put up the bar graph, say, well, you can see the class doesn't agree on this. I'm not going to tell you the answer. Turn to the person next to you and discuss with them what you now, what you think the right answer is and why. Well, don't even have to say and why. So then there's a peer discussion between neighbours. Then you get them to vote again. And so that peer discussion is really the heart of what transforms learning in these classes over a term, over a semester. It's been quite widely applied. There was a more recent paper in the journal Science, second highest impact factor in the publishing world, and showed it for first year genetics, but it was a more clever experiment. It didn't just show the gain in some detail, but they also controlled for a potential criticism, which was whether people just developed a better idea of the answer to that particular question, or whether they could transfer it to others. So in this superior design, which you'll find on the reading list, they had what they called isomorphic test questions. That is, the question they used to provoke peer discussion in class was paired with another one which was used in the test phase, and they demonstrated complete transfer. In fact, people would do slightly better on the transfer question than on the original one. So demonstrating that, yes, they'd learned the principles, not just the which option to select. So that's another big effect. It's shown a lot of transfer between teachers. Mazur showed that on this particular test of understanding, it at least doubled the amount that students got from the course. Now, I should say something about that, which is often barely mentioned, unless you read between the lines in these, and that is that the tests used for before and after are not the typical written exam with equations that a physics student would normally be judged on. Instead, they're very like the brain teasers. They're about the application of the principles to concrete situations in real life. And what would drove academic physicists mad was that students could get really good marks on the equations and then demonstrate they had absolutely no idea how that related to real situations. And that would make teachers feel ashamed. And it was the gain in that understanding measured in that way that was being demonstrated here. So just to recap about, by way of approaching the end, to recap about the roles in teaching is, it's actually clear that teachers can make a big difference, but generally not in the way that everyone tends to think about it. So I like to organize or conceptualize this in terms of teaching having three main roles, but being good at one doesn't say anything about whether you're good at another, that there are a few big results and a lot of mediocre results in how changing learning activities makes a difference. Chick sexing demonstrates their potentially gigantic gains, but we know very little about how that generalizes, although I believe it does for various reasons, and that delivery doesn't seem to be a bottleneck at university level in practice. Right. Now, I'll circulate the instruction list, but really I want you to, if you could bear to hand those out. There's a Xerox for everyone of a huge article which I was going to spend next week talking about. You won't be able to understand all that much next week unless you've made a start on grappling with this paper. It's if you prefer it online, you can get it out of the library. I've got the link up already on the course page. You can download your own copy if you prefer it to paper. But the point is, okay, so Mickey Chee has a long career, almost most of in psychology departments, the latter half of which, or more than half, has been in the educational area, and she's put together many important results, some of them about peer interaction, and this is a paper towards the end of her career, which is of particular interest because it claims basically that students watching a tutorial, where a tutorial is an expert tutor and a couple of students, watching the video of a tutorial do as well on post-tests as the students actually in the tutorial do. So one common argument it's tempting to believe is that you might be able to mass produce lectures by videoing them, but you can't mass produce personal interaction. But Chee's experiment here is challenging that, which seems to go against all common sense. So that's why it looks like it's important, why, and it brings up many issues about peer interaction and what the real levers are. But it also chimes in with a theme about what a teacher's good important for, and what aren't they actually needed for. It's unlikely you'll be able to digest this whole paper completely. I'll try and issue in the next day or two a way to break it down. But if you begin with the abstract and the conclusion, you'll understand her main claim. I think the next step then might be to pick a sub-issue in there and study that. So it's more important to try and understand the issues here. Whizzing through it briefly won't really help you all that much. She writes pretty well, but because this experiment comes after years of experiments, there's a lot of issues she's alerted to, which she discusses in turn and attempts to control with different conditions. So it's a lot to take in all the details, even though all of them are quite important in one way or another. So I'd like you to be ready to discuss this, at least in part. Right, thank you.